For Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up, where does the path to leadership begin? We'll hear from Sarah Pressler, the former mayor of Flagstaff, about what it takes to inspire others to lead. Find out about the Chinese New Year celebration that's welcoming in the Year of the Horse. We'll hear an essay about the ups and downs of becoming a gentrifier in one of Tucson's oldest Latino neighborhoods. And a short story by an Arizona prison inmate that tells how a broken skateboard once taught two men a lesson about hope. Those stories are next here on Arizona Spotlight. Former Flagstaff Mayor Sarah Pressler has held a number of leadership positions in her 34 years, and she says she's learned from all of them. Andrea Kelly recently interviewed Pressler as she was about to speak on leadership at the Tucson YWCA. Pressler says that at every step in her professional life, she's learned something that she can now teach to others.
I have been called to lead. Sometimes I hear it like it's a regular voice. And having been a psychiatric ward attorney, I don't think that makes me crazy. But I hear it.
That's Sarah Pressler's MO. All the things that make most of us think twice about voluntarily changing careers or taking risks that could lead to failure, such as running for office or starting a small business, fuel her drive. At 28 years old, Pressler became the first female mayor of Flagstaff. She left after two terms of 2 years each. She isn't full of ego, but she is very self-aware. For example, ask what skills helped her exceed in her career so far. It wasn't any skills, she says.
What we need are talents. You see, anybody can put a round peg in a round hole. But talents are transferable. They're the things and the experiences and the people and the lessons that we've learned. And they're the way that we apply them to a dynamic and ever-changing environment. So the talents that I'm able to bring to the table are a collection of the experiences that I've had.
She isn't calling them skills, but rather talents. In any case, Pressler says she developed those along the way as she was a deputy county prosecutor, a self-employed attorney, general counsel for an energy company, a professor, and CEO for a health advocacy organization.
I learned the power as general counsel of listening in a corporate environment to the needs of the business community and the needs of the private property owner and local governments as they try to navigate the renewable energy frontier in Arizona and across the country.
Pressler doesn't just talk about all she learned. She gives tips for others to use.
Not just talking the talk, but walking the walk.
She's now the CEO of the Arizona Foundation for Women, so she travels the state working to develop the next generation of leaders. One tip she gives is called the sandwich technique.
Tough conversations are just that, tough. But they need to happen. They need to happen in your private relationships, in your professional relationships, in your not-so-professional relationships. Tough conversations need to happen. So how do they happen? The sandwich technique. A delicious piece of white bread, a floppy piece of bologna, and a delicious piece of white bread.
She demonstrates the strategy, but here's the short version. Give a compliment, then a piece of constructive criticism, and then another slice of praise. It's right in line with everything else she's learned along the way, because all of it traces back to communication.
As an elected official, I learned the importance of working well with others. We resolved over 30 years of water tribal litigation in our community through the Navajo Hopi water settlement discussions and the progress and work we did with our indigenous neighbors in northern Arizona. I also had to learn that God gave me 2 ears and 1 mouth between my first and second term. Because when you've got a 28-year-old in charge, they think they have 2 mouths and 1 set of ears.
And campaigning for mayor before you're 30 can't be as easy as doing it after you've had more life experience. But it was the right time for Pressler. She said from the beginning she would run for just two terms, and in Flagstaff, mayors get terms of 2 years, so she served 4 years. Before and after, she learned from many other jobs.
As a public defender, I learned the importance of advocacy and giving a voice to those, like children and the mentally ill, that need someone to speak up for them and to speak the truth in an ethical manner.
It is not just about developing the connections, she says, but about how you get there.
There are extrinsic motivators, but they are short-term fixes. We know that when we can identify intrinsic motivators instead of extrinsic motivators, we are more effective at having long-term investments and success in the work that we're doing and the way that we're able to help others.
And once you have the right motivation aligned with the skills or talents for the job, she says the next step is in decision-making.
The distinction between traditional ways of thinking, this outcome-based thinking, contrasted with how women generally make decisions and how indigenous communities like the Hopi, who are a matriarchal community, make decisions, is through values. And by using and identifying our core values, we then arrive at the appropriate outcomes.
All of Pressler's advice has a common thread on the importance of communication. That's because one of her core values is recognizing the role other people play in her life.
I also developed, through being mayor and being a lawyer in private practice, the ability to build relationships with people. You see, relationships, they matter more than anything. If somebody's gonna give you $10 or owe you a favor, baby, take that favor, right? Skip the $10 and take the favor. Favors, relationships, interactions, they matter.
Andrea Kelly produced that story for Arizona Spotlight. To watch Pressler's entire speech, go to our website, news.azpm.org. Chinese folklore characterizes the horse as a symbol of prosperity and vitality, and that could be a good omen for the upcoming lunar calendar year of 4712. A 15-day New Year celebration begins today, and Luis Carrion speaks with Tucson Chinese Americans about this tradition that's now part of our local cultural landscape.
The Lunar New Year is China's most important cultural celebration, and this year begins today. Tina Liao is president of the Tucson Chinese Cultural Association. She says the celebration generates the world's largest mass migration as people rush to their hometowns to visit relatives.
So people in China, no matter where you are, they will try to travel back to where the parents are to show respect and then also reunion with the family members.
Liao says the Lunar New Year is like an entire country trying to have a family reunion all at the same time.
That's the most important thing, is the family reunion.
She's been able to go to China twice during the 25 years she's lived in Tucson. Because it's not always possible to travel, she says it's important for her and other members of the Chinese American community in Tucson to preserve the cultural traditions of this important holiday, many of which involve food.
The two things are the must. One is the fish, the whole fish. Usually the Chinese like to eat things as a whole, like chicken is a whole, duck is a whole, fish is a whole, because you have to start things with good beginning and a perfect ending. And then the other thing we must have for the New Year's Eve dinner is dumpling. So it's like a whole family joint effort to make the dumplings.
Liao is a relative newcomer in a community of Chinese immigrants in Tucson made up of students, working professionals, and many longtime residents that have multi-generational roots in the Southwest. She came to Tucson 25 years ago to study at the U of A, and she stayed to make a living and raise a family. According to Robin Blackwood, a member of the Tucson Chinese Cultural Center who has researched the Chinese immigrant population, the Old Pueblo has been home to Chinese immigrants for well over a century.
The records date from the 1870s and seem to show the Chinese arriving both from California and from Mexico, but it was only a few years later that there began to be Chinese grocers in the area, probably as early as 1879 or 1880.
Blackwood says what started as a few Chinese immigrants at the end of the 1800s grew steadily into the 20th century, and many new arrivals opened grocery stores in the predominantly Mexican neighborhoods of what is now downtown Tucson.
By the 1920s, they were very ensconced in the community as grocers, and some families would come and have multiple grocery stores so that one member would come and open a grocery store, and then his brother would come and open another grocery store. The sons would perhaps open grocery stores if they could figure out a way to get funding. And by the time of the 1940s, in a community of about 35,000 people, we have recorded over 100 Chinese grocery stores in Tucson during the 1940s.
The first year we moved to Tucson, my mother always slept in a basement because it was much cooler.
Arlene Lee lived with her parents in Anita Street Market in Barrio Anita.
And she could not take the heat in Tucson.
Her family came from California, and in this interview conducted in 2009 for an Arizona Public Media story on the history of Chinese grocery stores in Tucson, she describes how prevalent the merchants were in the Mexican communities.
Anita Street is the short one block thing, practically. And we had three grocery stores on that little street. And my friend Somi was on the store kind of diagonally across from us. Then a block to my right of our store, there was another grocery store. And there was no competition. I mean, I think the customers all had credit, of course.
There was literally a Chinese grocery store on each corner. And we know that in some little neighborhoods like Anita Street, which is only a mile long, that little street was served by about seven Chinese grocery stores.
Blackwood says the Chinese community in Tucson has continued to grow because travel to China can be expensive and time-consuming, especially during the Lunar New Year, which usually conflicts with school and work schedules. A local tradition has emerged.
Historically, I think they've probably always had celebrations in Tucson with firecrackers and things like that. And now we have a whole range of commemorations of the Lunar New Year.
The Tucson Chinese Cultural Center is hosting a community celebration of the Chinese New Year starting this weekend. The events feature food, art, and performances, says Susan Chan, volunteer coordinator and program manager at the Cultural Center.
We want everybody in the community to experience Chinese New Year with us.
Chan says the Lunar New Year is the most important holiday for the Chinese community, and the Cultural Center provides a venue for the entire Tucson community to participate.
Our building has been in existence for about 9 years. Our association has been in existence for over 50-some years. And the last 5 years, we started this Chinese New Year festival, and it's grown tremendously.
Tina Liao says the Lunar New Year celebration is about ushering in good fortune and dispelling all that is negative and harmful.
This year is the year of horse. The year of horse supposed to fly full of energy. It will bring lots of prosperity. So Chinese like to use this word, 马到成功. When the horse arrives, you are success. In English, I think it's called a speedy success.
The Lunar New Year celebration lasts 15 days and concludes this year on February 14th. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Luis Carrion.
The word gentrification may bring to mind cities such as New York or San Francisco. But closer to home, we'll hear the story of freelance producer Angus Anderson. He had the sinking feeling that he had become a gentrifier after buying a home in one of Tucson's oldest Latino neighborhoods.
This train is the grandchild of the Southern Pacific locomotive that sliced Tucson in half in 1880. Once, the town was integrated, but as it grew, Hispanics increasingly settled on the west and south sides, Anglos on the north and east. Recently, I bought a century-old pile of lava rocks and termites in Menlo Park, a neighborhood in the middle of the west side. The Menlo Park area started out as a Native American settlement, then whites moved in, and for the last 100 years, it's been Hispanic. It's one of the few neighborhoods in Tucson where families go back more than a generation.
My name's Angus, I'm a radio producer, uh-huh. And I just moved into Menlo Park, mm-hmm. And I'm doing a story on Menlo Park in Barrio Hollywood.
My husband's actually the one that grew up in the neighborhood, he lives a block down. His family's been here for 30, 35 years.
It's a bright day in Menlo Park, the park the neighborhood is named after. Sylvia Amparano stands next to a picnic table surrounded by a throng of children in red soccer jerseys.
There's a lot of elderly, too. My husband's grandparents have lived in the neighborhood for ever.
That's great.
But there are newcomers, too. Gene Einfrank has been here only 7 years, but he's become president of the Menlo Park Neighborhood Association. He lives in a new development around the Mercado San Agustin, a building designed to resemble a colonial Spanish market.
If you walk around the Mercado District, you see in the architecture a look back into Tucson's history.
The Mercado is also the end of a streetcar line that will cross the old railroad tracks, connecting Menlo Park to gentrifying areas around downtown and the University of Arizona. That's where I met Lydia Otero, a lifelong Tucsonan and historian.
The streetcar is going to appeal to a lot of people. They're going to want to move to Menlo Park. I personally have had conversations with people in Barrio Hollywood, and they have no reservations about calling people gentrifiers.
Barrio Hollywood is Menlo Park's sister neighborhood to the north. It was a locus of Chicano activism in the 70s. When people there picture gentrifiers, I have a feeling they see me.
All the properties they've sold downtown and all the smaller barrios have all been, I can't think of anybody of color.
Demographic and economic shifts aren't new, but in talking to my neighbors, I see they mean different things to different people. For Sylvia Amparano, it can be a good thing.
I don't think it's a negative. I don't see it as a negative. I think it's taking us to the next level, I guess.
Do you want a little more horchata?
Solomon Baldenegro doesn't seem worried about me either. He's a longtime neighborhood activist from Tucson's west side. As he presides over a plate of enchiladas, he tells me the real threat of gentrification comes from political elites bent on weakening neighborhood identity and unity.
There's a move afoot to dilute our political clout. And one of the ways to do it is to disperse us.
Solomon tells me about the city of Tucson's recent attempt to replace a municipal golf course with a for-profit university. For him, the golf course is symbolic. It's where he and other neighborhood activists pressured the city to carve a park and community center out of a predominantly white country club. Hispanics in Barrio Hollywood and Menlo Park have been a force in city politics ever since. The golf course deal has collapsed, but Solomon still thinks the city is trying to gentrify longtime residents out of Barrio Hollywood.
Well, you can disperse it because you'll still have 10,000 Mexican-American Democrats, but 5 here, 10 there, 100 there, they have no power.
Other people in Barrio Hollywood and Menlo Park favor the redevelopment project. It's a reminder that reactions to development and displacement can vary significantly, even within a small community. Back in the immaculate newness of the Mercado, Gene Einfrank and I sit across the street from old homes in various states of disrepair.
How do you keep people who are there from not getting driven out? You know, are we kind of prisoners of a much bigger system? I mean,
I think we are, and that's perhaps the unfortunate aspect. That's really hard to get around.
Neither of us wants to be a gentrifier. But larger economic and political pressures may shape Menlo Park's future more than we will, despite our best intentions.
That was freelance producer Angus Anderson. His essay originally aired on Latino USA. Anderson recently traveled the country to create The Conversation, a web series about the challenges of the future. You can find a link on our website at news.azpm.org.
Thank you.
Every Saturday, Eric Toso, an author and professor at the University of Arizona, visits a prison on Tucson's south side to lead a writing workshop. The poems and stories written by the inmates often contain indelible moments of truth, sadness, and beauty. Last April on this show, Eric Toso read a short story by inmate Aaron Keel called Acts of Kindness. That story inspired a listener, director and producer Troy Holler, to talk with Toso and Keel about making a film adaptation of the story. He succeeded in his project. It's called Grace of a Stranger, and it will have its debut screenings in Tucson next month. We have a link for information online at news.azpm.org. But right now, here's Eric Toso reading Aaron Keel's original story.
So it's a little longer piece. It's a prose piece. It's written by a guy named Aaron Keel. And the subject for this assignment for, writing practice was to write about an act of kindness. And so he titled this one just simply, Acts of Kindness. All I owned was a couple of changes of clothes, a few notepads, an MP3 player loaded with punk and hip-hop, and my Skullcandy headphones. I carried it all in an army green backpack and traveled the streets of Phoenix on my skateboard, which also served as a pillow. After a few months of winter cold followed by a hot spring, a rage started building up inside of me. I started hating the world. I already hated myself, so I just skated. One day in the thick of my hatred, I was practicing hard flips and 360 flips in the local mall parking lot, sweating out some of my anger. Over and over, I would pop the board into the air, watch it spin underneath my feet, then try to catch it midair right on top of the bolts before slamming the board back down to the asphalt and riding away. On one of my attempts at perfecting this, my left foot fell too far to the back, right on the tip of the tail, and the board snapped. I yelled. I cussed. I sat down there on the hot asphalt, letting the sweat drip off my forehead into my eyes. That piece of wood on wheels was one of the few pieces of happiness I had left, and a friend at that. I looked up to the sky. There were no answers in the blue. And then I looked to the mall with a van skate shop tucked away in the back corner. My pockets were empty, but somewhere deep inside me there was a glimmer of hope shining as I picked up my backpack and the broken deck and walked to the air-conditioned shop. I walked into the store, my eyes filling with shiny new decks hanging on the walls like psychedelic posters in a burned-out hippie's room. A salesman was leaning over the counter wearing an old F-U-C-T t-shirt with Bert from Sesame Street standing behind a bent-over Ernie with both of their pants down around their ankles. "Looks like you have a casualty on your hands," he says. "Yeah," I mumbled, not quite looking in his eyes. "Well, what's up? Looks like you need a new deck." "That's the problem. I have no money. I'm homeless, and my effing board just broke. Do you guys have any old decks lying around that you're not going to use, that you're going to throw out? Or maybe any friends who might have a deck they're willing to give up for a man a little SOL?" I ask, practically begging, as I bounce from foot to foot, nervously. "You know what, dude? I have this great Cowtown deck in here that some kid just switched out. There are no cracks or chips, and it's not warped at all," he says, reaching under the counter, pulling out the deck. "Let me get you some tools, and you can go ahead and put it together right now." "I can have this for nothing?" I ask, holding up the almost new Cowtown deck and looking for some defect to let me know this is all a cruel joke. "Hell yeah, buddy! We've all been there before, and I'm always willing to help out a fellow skater. Let me know if you need any help. There's some extra hardware in this box if you need some," he said, as his teeth shone like the halos above the heads of angels in a religious painting. I put together the board, thanked him, and walked out of there. I started up conversations with people again. I knew then that there was still hope. The anger I felt before vanished, and the sun shone brighter, at least for a couple of weeks.
That was Eric Toso reading Acts of Kindness, written by Aaron Keel, an inmate in the Arizona prison system. Director Troy Holler's film adaptation is called Grace of a Stranger, and you can see the trailer on our website at news.azpm.org. Thank you for listening to Arizona Spotlight. The show originates from the AZPM radio studios. The production engineer is Jim Blackwood. The music is by Calexico. I'm producer and host Mark McLemore.